Chapter 6. The miracle of hindsight is how it transforms great military geniuses of the past into incompetent idiots, and incompetent idiots of the present into great military geniuses. There is the door, and be sure to take all your pompous second-guessing delusions with you. Emperor Kellenved, on the occasion of the conquest of Falari's Grand Council, the Trial of Crust. There had been an earthquake. A spine of rock nearly a league long had simply dropped away, opening an inlet to the sea. There were no silts churned up by this cataclysm, for the spine was a lifeless conglomeration of obsidian and pumice, legacy of past eruptions. At its apex, the inlet was sharply angled, the sides sheer rock. That angle widened on its way out to the sea, flanked at the mouth by twin upthrusts of rock a quarter league apart. The inlet's floor was inclined. The water at the apex was no more than 15 spans deep, crystal clear, revealing a jumble of blockish stones and white bones cluttering the bottom, remnants of Tholos tombs and the Kachane Chimal that had been interred within them. Ruins were visible on both sides of the cut, including a mostly toppled Jagat tower. In the sky above a tortured rack of hills, just to the north, hovered the stain of a gate, a mottled scar in the air itself. All that bled from it now was pain, a sour, unyielding stench that seemed as thirsty as the ravaged landscape stretching out on all sides. Traveller stood staring up at the gate for a long time. 2 days now from the spot where he had washed up, and he had yet to find fresh water. The blood of the bear that had attacked him had sustained him for a time, but that had been salty nectar, and now he suffered. There had been enough conspiracies intent on achieving his death over the course of his life thus far to have made a lesser man long since despair, tumbling into madness or suicide in one last surrender to the hunger of gods and mortals. It would be, perhaps, rather just if he was to fail now for lack of the most basic staples needed to keep one alive. But he would not surrender, for he could hear a god's laughter, as ironic as a loving whisper in his ear. Somewhere inland, he was sure, this blasted waste would crumble into sweeps of dusty earth, and then grasses, a wind-stirred prairie and steppes, if only he could hold on long enough to reach it. He had skinned the bear and now carried the hide in a wrapped bundle slung from one shoulder. Although not particularly attractive, it provided a scent disguising his own, and one that would send most carnivores scurrying. Conversely, he would need to stalk game, assuming he ever found any, from upwind, but that would have been true even without the skin. He was on the coast of Morn. Far from where he had intended to make landfall here on the Jennebachan continent. A long walk awaited him, but there was nothing new in that prospect, nor, he had to admit, in the threat of failure. Facing inland, Traveller set out, boots crunching on black, bubbled glass. The morning sun reflected from the mottled surface in blinding flashes, and the heat swirled up around him until he was sheathed in sweat. He could see the far end, a few thousand paces distant, or thought he could, knowing well how the eyes could be deceived, a darker stretch, like a raised beach of black sand drawn across the horizon, with nothing visible beyond. Sometime later he was certain that the ridge was not an illusion, a wind-banked, undulating heap of crushed obsidian, a diamond glitter that cut into his eyes. As he drew closer, he thought he could hear faint moaning, as of some as yet unfelt wind. And now he could see beyond, another vast stretch of featureless plain, with no end visible through the shimmering heat. Ascending the rise, boots sinking deep into the sand, Traveller heard the moaning wind once more, and he looked up to see that something had appeared on the plain directly ahead. A high-backed throne, the figure seated upon it a blurred cast of shadows. Standing perhaps 10 paces to the right was a second figure, this one wrapped in a dark grey cloak, the hood pulled back to reveal a wind-burned profile and a shock of black hair cut short. From behind the throne now emerged hounds, padding forward, their paws kicking up puffs of dust that drifted in their wake. Baran, Gear, Blind, Shan and Rude, and two others Traveller had never seen before. Bone white, both of them, with onyx eyes, leaner than the others, longer necked and covered in scars that displayed a startling dark blue skin beneath the short white hair. Moving as a pair, they ranged out to the far right, inland, and lifted noses to the air. The other hounds came straight for Traveller. He walked down to meet them. Shan was the first to arrive, pulling up along one side, then slinking like a cat around his back to come up on the other. He settled his left hand on her sleek black neck. Ancient Baran was next, and Traveller reached out to set his other hand against one muscled cheek, feeling the skein of seamed scars from centuries of savage combat, the hint of crushing molars beneath the ragged but soft skin. Looking into the beast's light brown eyes, he found he could not hold the gaze for long. Too much sorrow, too much longing for peace, for which he could give no benison. Baran leaned his head into that caress and then rasped a thick tongue against Traveller's forearm. With the huge beasts all round him now, excepting the two white ones, Traveller approached the throne. As he drew nearer, Cotillion finally faced him. "You look terrible, old friend." Traveller smiled, not bothering to respond in kind. Cotillion's face betrayed exhaustion, beyond anything he had ever seen when the man had been mortal, when he had been named Dancer, when he had shared the rule of an empire. Where were the gifts of godhood? What was their value when to grasp each one was to flinch in pain and leak blood from the hands? "You too," Traveller said, eyes settling now on Shadow Throne. "Banish my every regret."
"That won't last, I'm sure,"
hissed the god on his throne.
"Where is your army, First Sword? I see only dust in your wake."
"While you sit here, claiming dominion over a wasteland."
"Enough of the mutual appreciation. You are beset, old friend. How often do I use those words, eh? Old friends. Oh, where are they now? How far fallen? Scattered to the winds, stumbling hopelessly unguided and blind."
"You never had that many friends, Kelanved."
"Beset, I was saying. By nightfall, you will be dead of dehydration. It is 4 days or more to the first spring on the Lammertath Plain."
"I see."
"Of course, no matter where you happen to be when you finally die, your old friend is bound to come find you."
"Yes, I am sure he will."
"To gloat in victory."
"Hood does not gloat."
"Well, that's a disappointing notion. So he will come to not gloat, then. No matter. The point is, you will have lost."
"And my success, or lack thereof, matters to you, Kelanved?"
Cotillion replied, "Surprisingly, yes, it does."
"Why?"
That blunt question seemed to take both gods aback for a moment. Then Shadow Throne snorted.
"Does it matter? Hardly. Not at all, in fact. We are here to help you, you damned oaf. You stubborn, obstinate, belligerent fool. Why I ever considered you an old friend entirely escapes me. You are too stupid to have been one, ever. Look, even Cotillion is exasperated by your dim-wittedness."
"Mostly amused, actually," Cotillion corrected, now grinning at Traveller. "I was just reminded of our, discussions in the command tent when on campaign. Perhaps the most telling truth of old friendships is in how their dynamics never change."
"Including your smarmy postulations," said Shadow Throne dryly. "Listen, you Traveller, or however you call yourself now, My hounds will guide you to your salvation. Ah, how often has that been said? In the meantime, we will give you skins of water, dried fruit, and the like. The myriad irritating needs of mortality, I seem to recall. Vaguely, whatever.
And what do you seek in return for this gift?
A dozen heartbeats passed with no reply forthcoming. Traveler's face slowly descended into a dangerous frown.
I will not be swayed from my task, not even delayed.
No, of course not.
Shadow Throne waved an ephemeral hand.
The very opposite, in fact. We urge you. We exhort you. Make haste, set true your course, seek out your confrontation. Let nothing and no one stand in your way.
Traveler's frown deepened, a soft laugh from Cotillion.
No need. He speaks true, First Sword. It is our pleasure to enable you in this particular matter. I will not bargain with him.
We know.
I am not sure you fully understand.
We do.
I mean to kill Hood. I mean to kill the God of Death.
Best of luck to you,
said Shadow Throne. More silence. Cotillion then came forward, carrying supplies that had not been there a moment ago. He set them down.
Shan will lead the way,
he said quietly, stepping back. Traveler glanced over at the two new hounds.
And those ones?
Cotillion followed his gaze, looking momentarily troubled before he shrugged.
Hard to say. They just sort of showed up.
I summoned them, of course,
said Shadow Throne.
The white one is named Pallid. The whiter one is named Locke. 7 is the desired number, the necessary number.
Shadow Throne, Cotillion said, you did not summon them.
I must have. Why else would they be here? I'm sure I did at some point. A wish, perhaps, whilst staring upward at the stars. Or a desire, yes, of such overwhelming power that even the abyss could not deny me.
The others seem to have accepted them, Cotillion noted, shrugging again.
Has it occurred to you,
said Traveler softly to the god standing before him,
that they might be the fabled hounds of light?
Really? Why would you think that? And in that moment, when Cotillion met his eyes and winked, all the exhaustion, the very immortality of ascendancy itself, vanished, and Traveler saw once more, after what seemed a lifetime, the man he had once called his friend. Yet he could not bring himself to smile, to yield any response at all to that gesture and the invitation it offered. He could not afford such weakness. Not now, perhaps never again. Certainly not with what these two old friends had become.
They are gods, and gods are not to be trusted.
Reaching down, he collected the skins and the knapsack.
Which one drove the bear to the coast?
He asked.
Gear, you needed food, or you would not have got even this far. I was very nearly its supper, Cotillion.
We have always had faith in you, First Sword. The next, and probably last, question Traveler had for the god was the most difficult one to voice.
And which of you wrecked my ship and killed my crew?
Cotillion's brows lifted.
Not us. Dasem, we would not do that.
Traveler studied the god's eyes, always softer than one might have expected, but he had long since grown used to that, and then he turned away.
All right.
Pallid and Locke fell in as reluctant, desultory rearguard as the hounds escorted Traveler inland. Shadow Throne had managed to turn his throne round so that he could watch the First Sword and his entourage slowly dwindle into the northeast. Standing nearby, Cotillion lifted his hands and looked down upon the palms, seeing the glistening sweat pooling there. That was close.
Eh? What was?
If he had decided we were behind the shipwreck, well, I don't like to think what would have happened here.
Simple, Cotillion. He would have killed us.
And the hounds would not have interceded.
Except perhaps my newest pets. No old loyalties there.
Close, said Cotillion again.
You could have just told him the truth. That Mail wanted him and wanted him badly. That we had to reach in and drag him out. He would have been far more thankful with all that.
Gratitude is a useless luxury in this instance, Shadow Throne. No distractions, remember. Nothing and no one to turn Traveler from his fated destiny. Leave Mail for another time.
Yes, very good. A detail we can offer Traveler when our need for him is immediate and, pressing. We delved, following the suggestion he set us this day, in this place, and lo, why, none other than the Elder God of the Seas was to blame. Now get over here and draw that damned sword and hack these enemies to pieces.
That is not the delving we need to do right now, Cotillion said.
Well, of course not. We already know. What need delving?
Cotillion faced Shadow Throne. Mail could have killed him easily enough, don't you think? Instead, he set out to delay Traveler. We need to think on that. We need to figure out why.
Yes, I am beginning to see. Suspicions awakened. I was momentarily careless, unmindful. Delay, yes. Why? What value?
I just realized something.
What? Quick, tell me!
It doesn't matter what Mail had in mind. It won't work.
Explain!
Mail assumes a quarry on the run, after all.
Yes, he must, of course. No other possibility. Mail doesn't get it, the idiot. Now let's get out of this ash heap. My throat's getting sore.
Cotillion stared after the hounds and their charge, squinting against the bright sunlight. Timing, Shadow Throne.
Perfection!
So far.
We will not fail.
We'd better not.
Which among our newfound allies do you imagine the weak link?
Cotillion glanced back at Shadow Throne. Well, you, of course.
Apart from me, I mean.
Cotillion stared. Shadow Throne waited, fidgeting on his throne. Midnight at the lone tavern of Morsco provided Nemander with memories he would never lose. Slack-eyed, black-mouthed villagers staggering forward, colliding with him and the others. Stained bottles thrust into their faces, eyes smeared with something murky and yellowed. The drink was potent enough to numb tongues if the exhorting moans were in truth invitations to imbibe. Even without Clip's earlier warning, Nemander was not inclined to accept such hospitality, nor, he saw with some relief, were any of his kin. They stood, still crowded at the entrance, bemused and uneasy. The pungent air of the low-ceilinged chamber was sweet, overlying strains of acrid sweat and something like living decay. Skintik moved up alongside Nemander, and they both watched as Clip, Desra at his side, made his way to the counter. A simple jug of wine? Anywhere in this place? Not likely. Nemander suspected Skintik was right. All he could see at every table, in every hand, was the same long-necked flask with its blackened mouth. The moans were louder now, cacophonous like the lowing of beasts in an abattoir. Nemander saw one man, an ancient, bent, emaciated creature, topple face first onto the wood-slatted floor, audibly smashing his nose. Someone close by stepped back, crushing the hapless man's fingers under a heel. "So, where is the priest?" Nemander asked from behind Nemander and Skintik. It was his invitation after all. For once, Nananda, Skintik said without turning, I am pleased to have you standing here, hand on sword. I don't like this.
None here can hurt us, Nananda pronounced,
yet his tone made it plain he was pleased by Skintik's words.
Listen to me, he said. Wild Clip is not close by. He holds us all in contempt.
Nimanda slowly turned round as Skintik said, We'd noticed. What do you make of that, brother?
He sees what he chooses to see.
Nimanda saw that Kedavis and Aranatha were listening, and the faint doe-like expression on the latter's face was suddenly gone, replaced by a chilling emptiness that Nimanda knew well.
It is no matter, Nimanda said, sudden sweat prickling awake beneath his clothes. Leave it, Nananda. It is no matter.
But it is, Nananda retorted. He needs to know why we survived our battles when all the others fell. He needs to understand.
That's over with now, Nimanda insisted.
No, said Skintik. Nananda is right this time, Nimanda. He is right. Clip wants to take us to this dying god, after all. Whatever he plans disregards us, as if we did not exist. Voiceless.
Useless,
cut in Nananda. Nimanda looked away. More villagers were collapsing, and those on the floorboards had begun twitching, writhing in pools of their own waste. Sightless eyes rolled ecstatically in sunken sockets.
If I have made us voiceless, I'm sorry.
Enough of that rubbish, Skintik said conversationally.
I agree, said Nananda. I didn't before. I was angry with you, Nimanda, for not telling this so-called mortal sword of darkness, telling him about us, who we were, what we've been through. So I tried to do it myself, but it's no use. Clip doesn't listen, not to anyone but himself.
What of Desra? Nimanda asked.
Nananda snorted. She covets her own mystery. That was a sharp observation from Nananda, surprising Nimanda. But it was not an answer to what he had meant with his question. Skintik, however, understood.
She remains one of us, Nimanda. When the need arrives, you need not doubt her loyalty.
Kedavis spoke then with dry contempt.
Loyalty is not one of Desra's virtues, brothers. Set no weight upon it.
Skintik sounded amused when he asked, Which of Desra's virtues should we set weight upon, then, Kedavis?
When it comes to self-preservation, she replied, Desra's judgment is precise. Never wrong, in fact. She makes surviving the result of profound clarity. Desra sees better and sharper than any of us. That is her virtue.
Clip was on his way back, Desra now clinging to his left arm as might a woman struggling against terror.
The dying god is about to arrive, Clip said.
He had put away his chain and rings, and from his palpable unease there now rose, like a dark cloud, the promise of violence.
You should all leave. I don't want to have to cover you if this turns bad. I won't have the time, nor will I accept blame if you start dying. So for all our sakes, get out of here.
It was, Nimanda would recall later, the moment when he could have stepped forward, could have looked into Clip's eyes, unwavering, revealing his own defiance and the promise behind it. Instead, he turned to the others.
Let's go, he said.
Nananda's eyes widened, a muscle twitching one cheek. Then he spun about and marched out of the tavern. With an expression that might have been shame, Skintik reached out to prise Desra away from Clip, then guided her out. Aranatha met Nimanda's eyes and nodded, but the meaning of the gesture eluded him, given the vast emptiness in her eyes. Then she and Kedavis exited the taproom, leaving Nimanda and Clip.
It pleases me, said Clip, that you take orders as well as you do, Nimanda, and that the others still choose to listen to you. Not, he added, that I think that will last much longer.
Do not confront this dying god, Nimanda said.
Not here, not now.
Excellent advice. I have no intention of doing so. I simply would see it.
And if it is not pleased at being seen by one such as you, Clip?
He grinned.
Why do you think I sent you to safety? Now go, Nimanda, back to our rooms. Comfort your frightened rabbits.
Outside, beneath a glorious sweep of bright stars, Nimanda found his kin in a tight huddle in the center of the main street. Rabbits? Yes, it might look that way. From the tavern, they could hear the frenzied moaning reach a fierce pitch, and the sound was now echoing, seeming to roll back in from the hills and fields surrounding the village. "Do you hear that?" Skintik asked. "Nimanda, do you hear it? The scarecrows, they are singing."
"Mother Dark,"
breathed Kedavis in horror. "I want to see one of those fields," Skintik suddenly said. "Now, who is with me?" When no one spoke, Nimanda said, "You and me, Skintik. The rest to our rooms. Nimanda, stand vigil until we return." Nimanda and Skintik watched as Nimanda purposefully led the others away. Then they set out into a side alley, feet thumping on the dusty, hard-packed ground. Another voice had joined all the others, emerging from the temple, a cry of escalating pain, a cry of such suffering that Nimanda staggered, his legs like water beneath him. He saw Skintik stumble, fall onto his knees, then push himself upright once more. Tears squeezed from his eyes, Nimanda forced himself to follow. Old house gardens to either side, filled with abandoned yokes, ploughs, and other tools, the furrows overgrown with weeds like bleached hair in the starlight. Gods, they've stopped eating. All is in the drink. It feeds them even as it kills them. That sepulchral wail was dwindling now, but it would rise again, he knew, with the next breath. Midnight in the tavern, the foul nectar was drunk down, and the god in terrible pain was summoned, the gate to his tormented soul forced open. Fed by immortal pain, the prostrate worshippers spasmed in ecstasy. He could see their blackened mouths, the writhing black tongues, the eyes in their smudge pits. He could see that old man with the smashed nose and the broken fingers. And Clip remained inside, witness to the madness, to its twisted face, and when the eyes opened and fixed on his own...
"Hurry,"
groaned Nimanda as he came up against Skintik, but as he moved past, his cousin reached out and grasped hold of his tunic, drawing Nimanda to a halt. They were at the edge of a field. Before them, in the cold silver light, the rows of scarecrows were all in motion, limbs writhing like gauze-wrapped serpents or blind worms. Black blood was streaming down. The flowers of the horrid plants had opened, exuding clouds of pollen that flashed like phosphorescence, riding the currents of night air. And Nimanda wanted to rush into that field, into the midst of the crucified victims. He wanted to taste that pollen on his tongue, on the back of his throat. He wanted to dance in the god's pain. Skintik, weeping, was dragging him back, though it seemed he was fighting his own battle. So taut were his muscles, so contradictory their efforts that they fell against one another, onto the ground. Clawing on their bellies now, back down the dirt track. The pollen is in the air. We have breathed it, and now... Gods below, now we hunger for more. Another terrible shriek, the voice of a physical thing trying to climb into the sky. But there was nothing to grasp, no handholds, no footholds, and so it shot out to the sides, closing icy cold grips upon throats, and a voice screaming into their faces. "You dance, you drink deep my agony. What manner of vermin are you? Cease, leave me, release me." A thousand footsteps charging through Nimanda's brain, dancers unending, unable to stop even had they wanted to, which they did not. No, let it go on and on. Gods forever. There, in the trap of his mind, he saw the old man and his blood and nectar-smeared face, saw the joy in the eyes, saw the suppleness of his limbs, his straightened back, every crippling knob and protuberance gone, tumors vanished. He danced in the crowd, one with all the others, exalted and lost in that exaltation. Nimanda realized that he and Skintik had reached the main street. As the god's second cry died away, some sanity crept back into his mind. He pushed himself onto his feet, dragging Skintik up with him. Together they ran, staggering headlong for the inn. Did salvation beckon? Or had Nimanda and the others fallen as well? Were they now dancing in the fields, selves torn away, flung into that black turgid river? A third cry, yet more powerful, more demanding. Nimanda fell, pulled down by Skintik's weight. Too late, they would turn about, rise, set out for the field. The pain held him in its deadly, delicious embrace. Too late now! He heard the inn's door slam open behind them. Then Arunatha was there, blank-eyed, dark skin almost blue, reaching down to grasp them both by their cloaks. The strength she kept hidden was unveiled suddenly, and they were being dragged towards the door, where more hands took them, tugged them inside, and all at once the compulsion vanished. Gasping, Nimanda found himself lying on his back, staring up at Kedavis's face, wondering at her calculating, thoughtful expression. A cough from Skintik at his side.
Mother Dark, save us!
Not her, said Kedavis, just Arunatha.
Arunatha, who flinches at shadows, ducks beneath the cry of a hunting hawk. She hides her other self behind a wall no power can surmount, hides it until it's needed. Yes, he could feel her now, an emanation of will filling the entire chamber, assailed but holding, as it would, as it must. Another cough from Skintik. Oh dear! And Nimanda understood. Klip was out there. Klip face to face with the dying god. Unprotected. Mortal sword of darkness. Is that protection enough? But he feared it was not. Feared it because he did not believe Klip was the mortal sword of anything. He faced Skintik. What do we do? I don't know. He may already be lost. Nimanda glanced over at Arunatha. Can we make it to the tavern? She shook her head.
We should never have left him, announced Nimanda. Don't be an idiot, Kedavis snapped.
Skintik still sat on the floor, clawing periodically at his face, racked with shivers.
What manner of sorcery afflicts this place? How can a god's blood do this?
Nimanda shook his head. I have never heard of anything like what is happening here, Skintik. The dying god. It bleeds poison. He struggled to keep from weeping. Everything seemed stretched thin, moments from tearing to pieces, a reality all at once in tatters, whipped away on mad winds. Skintik's sigh was ragged.
Poison? Then why do I thirst for more?
There was no answer for that. Is this a truth made manifest? Do we all feed on the pain of others? Do we laugh and dance upon suffering simply because it is not our own? Can such a thing become addictive, an insatiable need? All at once the distant moaning changed pitch, became screams, terrible, raw, the sounds of slaughter. Nananda was suddenly at the door, his sword out.
Wait, cried Kedavis. Listen, that's not him, that's them. He's murdering them all. Do you want to help, Nananda? Do you?
Nananda seemed to slump. He stepped back, shaken, lost. The shrieks did not last long, and when the last one wavered, sank into silence, even the dying god's cries had stilled. Beyond the door of the inn, there was nothing, as if the village, the entire outside world, had been torn away. Inside, none slept. Each had pulled away from the others, coveting naught but their own thoughts, listening only to the all-too-familiar voice that was a soul's conversation with itself. On the faces of his kin, Nimanda saw, there was dull shock, a bleakness to the staring, unseeing eyes. He felt the surrender of Arunatha's will, her power, as the threat passed, as she withdrew once more so far inward that her expression grew slack, almost lifeless, a shy, skittering look not ready to awaken once more. Desra stood at the window, the inside shutters pulled to either side, staring out upon an empty main street as the night crawled on, leaving Nimanda to wonder at the nature of her internal dialogue, if such a thing existed, if she was not just a creature of sensation, riding currents of instinct, every choice reframed into simple demands of necessity.
There is cruelty in your thoughts,
Fayard. Leave me alone, ghost.
Don't get me wrong, I approve. Desra is a slut. She has a slut's brain, the kind that confuses giving with taking, gift with loss, invitation with surrender. She is power's whore, Nimanda, and so she stands there, waiting to see him, waiting to see this strutting murderer that she would take to her bed. Confusions, yes, death with life, desperation with celebration, fear with need and lust with love.
Go away.
But you don't really want that, because then it would leave you vulnerable to that other voice in your head. The sweet woman murmuring all those endearing words. Do I recall ever hearing such when she was alive?
Stop.
In the cage of your imagination, blissfully immune to all that was real. The cruel indifferences, yes. You make so much of so little, Nimanda. A chance smile, a look. In your cage she lies in your arms, and this is the purest love, isn't it? Unsullied, eternal.
Stop, Fayard. You know nothing. You were too young, too self-obsessed, to see anything of anyone else, unless it threatened you.
And she was not a threat?
You never wanted me that way. Don't be absurd, ghost. Don't invent.
I invent nothing. You were just too blinded to see what was right in front of you. And did she die at the spear of a Tist Edur? Did she truly? Where was I at that moment, Nimanda? Do you recall seeing me at all?
No, this was too much. But she would not relent.
Why do you think the idea of killing Sandalath was so easy for me? My hands were already stained.
Stop! Laughter ringing through his head. He willed himself to say nothing, waited for those chilling peals of mirth to dwindle, grow ever fainter. When she spoke again in his mind, there was no humor at all in her tone.
Nenanda wants to replace you. He wants the command you possess, the respect the others hold for you. He will take it when he sees his chance. Do not trust him, Nimanda. Strike first, a knife in the back. Just as you acted to stop me, so you must do again, and this time you cannot fail. There will be no withal there to finish the task. You will have to do it yourself.
Nimanda lifted his gaze, looked upon Nenanda, the straight back, the hand resting on pommel. No, you are lying.
Delude yourself if you must, but not for much longer. The luxury must be short-lived. You will need to show your decisiveness, and soon.
And how many more kin do you want to see dead, Fayard?
My games are done with. You ended them once and for all. You and the swordsmith. Hate me if you will, but I have talents, and I gift them to you, Nimanda. You were the only one to ever listen to me, the only one to whom I opened my heart.
Heart? That vile pool of spite you so loved to swim in? That was your heart.
You need me. I give strength where you are weakest. Oh, make the bitch murmur of love. Fill her mouth with all the right words, if it helps. But she cannot help you with the hard choices a leader must make. Nenanda believes he can do better. See it in his eyes, so quick to challenge.
It's growing light, Desra said from the window. She turned. I think we should go out, to the tavern. It may be he is wounded. It may be he needs our help.
I recall him not asking for it, growled Nenanda.
He is not all-powerful, said Desra. Though he might affect such, it comes with being so young.
Nimanda stared across at her. Where did that insight come from?
Clip is vulnerable?
Kedavis asked in mock surprise.
Be quick to take advantage of that, Desra. The endless siege that is your envy grows wearisome, Kedavis.
Kedavis paled at that and said nothing. Oh, we are a vicious bunch, are we not? Nimanda rubbed at his face, then said, Let's go, then, and see for ourselves what has become of him. Desra was first through the door. Out into pale silvery light, a cerulean sky devoid of clouds, looking somehow speckled with grit. The harvested plants drooped in their racks, sodden with dew, the bulbs like swollen heads lined up in rows above the latticework. Nimanda saw, as he paused out on the street, that the temple's doors were ajar.
Clip was lying on the wooden sidewalk in front of the tavern, curled up, so covered in dried blood that he might have been a figure molded in black mud. They set out towards him. Clip's eyes were open, staring. Nimanda wondered if he was dead until he saw the slow rise and fall of his chest, but showing no awareness of anything, even as they closed round him, even as Nimanda knelt in front of him. Skintik moved up to the tavern doors, pushed them open, and stepped inside. He staggered out a moment later, both hands covering his face as he stumbled out into the middle of the street and stood there, back to the others. Slaughter. He slaughtered them all. Clip's sword was lying nearby, thick with gore, as if the entire weapon had been dragged through some enormous beast.
"They took something from him," Aranatha said. "Gone. Gone away."
Nananda broke into a jog, straight for the temple opposite. "Gone for good?" Nimanda asked Aranatha.
"I don't know."
"How long can he live this way?" She shook her head.
"Force food and water into him. Keep his wounds clean."
Long moments when no one spoke, when it seemed not a single question could be found, could be cleaned off and uttered in the name of normality. Nananda returned.
"They fled, the priests, all fled. Where was the dying god supposed to be?"
"A place named Bastion," said Kedavis. "West of here, I think."
"We need to go there," Nimanda said, straightening to face the others. Nananda bared his teeth.
"To avenge him!"
"To get him back," Nimanda retorted. "To get back to him whatever they took." Aranatha sighed.
"Nimanda."
"No, we go to Bastion. Nananda, see if there are any horses, or better yet, an ox and wagon. There was a large stable behind the inn." He looked down at Clip. "I don't think we have the time to walk." As the three women set out to collect the party's gear, followed for the moment by Nananda, Nimanda turned to study the tavern's entrance. He hesitated. Even from here he could see something. Dark, sprawled shapes, toppled chairs, and now the buzz of flies spun out from the gloom within.
"Don't," said Skintik behind him. "Nimanda, don't. I have seen dead people before. Not like these. Why? They are all smiling."
Nimanda faced his closest friend, studied his ravaged face, and then nodded. After a moment, he asked, "What made the priests flee?"
"Aranatha, I think," answered Skintik.
Nimanda nodded, believing the same. They had taken Clip, even with all the dead villagers, the priests had taken Clip, perhaps his very soul, as a gift to the dying god. But they could do nothing against the rest of them, not while Aranatha resisted. Fearing retribution, they fled in the night, away, probably to Bastion, to the protection of their god.
"Nimanda," said Skintik in a low, hollow voice, "we are forced. Yes. Awakened once more. Yes. I had hoped. Never again." "I know, Skintik. You would rather smile and jest, as befits your blessed nature. Instead, the face you will turn towards what is to come, it will be no different from ours. And have we not all looked upon one another in those times? Have we not seen the mirrors we became to each other? Have we not recoiled? Awakened." What lay in the tavern was only the beginning, merely Clip and his momentary failing frenzy. From this point on, what comes belongs to us. To that, even Fayard was silent. While somewhere in the mists of his mind, so faint as to be almost lost, a woman wept. It was a quirk of blind optimism that held that someone broken could, in time, heal, could reassemble all the pieces and emerge whole, perhaps even stronger for the ordeal, certainly wiser, for what else could be the reward for suffering? The notion that did not sit well with anyone was that one so broken might remain that way, neither dying, and so removing the egregious example of failure from all mortal eyes, nor improving.
A ruined soul should not be stubborn, should not cling to what was clearly a miserable existence. Friends recoil, acquaintances drift away, and the one who fell finds a solitary world, a place where no refuge could be found from loneliness, when loneliness was the true reward of surviving forever maimed, forever weakened. Yet who would not choose that fate when the alternative was pity? Of course, pity was a virtually extinct sentiment among the Tist-Andi, and this Endest Silan saw as a rare blessing among his kind. He could not have suffered such regard for very long. As for the torment of his memories, well, it was truly extraordinary how long one could weather that assault. Yet he knew he was not unique in this matter. It was the burden of his entire people, after all. Sufficient to mitigate his loneliness? Perhaps. Darkness had been silent for so long now. His dreams of hearing the whisper of his realm, of his birthplace, were less than ashes. It was no wonder, then, was it, that he now sat in the gloom of his chamber, sheathed in sweat, each trickle seeming to drink all warmth from his flesh? Yes, they had manifested Khorald Galain here in this city, an act of collective will. Yet it was a faceless power. Mother Dark had left them, and no amount of desire on their part could change that.
So then, what is this? Who speaks with such power?
Not a whisper, but a shout, a cry that bristled with... what?
With affront, indignation, outrage. Who is this?
He knew that he was not alone in sensing this assault. Others must be feeling it throughout Black Coral. Every Tist-Andi probably sat or stood motionless at this moment, heart pounding, eyes wide with fear and wonder, and perhaps hope. Could it be? He thought to visit the temple, to hear from the High Priestess herself, something, a pronouncement, a recognition proclaimed. Instead, he found himself staggering out of his room, hurrying up the corridor, and then ascending the stairs, round and round as if caught in a swirling fever, out into his lord's south-facing domain, stumbling in to find Anamanda Rake seated in his high-backed chair, facing the elongated window, and, far below, crashing seas painted black and silver as deep unknown currents thrashed.
"My lord!" Endest gasped.
"Did I have a choice?" Anamanda Rake asked, gaze still on the distant tumult.
"My lord?"
"Carcanas, did you agree with her assessment, Endest Silan? Did I not see true what was to come? Before Light's arrival, we were in a civil war, vulnerable to the forces soon to be born. Without the blood of Tiamatha, I could never have enforced peace, unification."
"Sire," said Endest Silan, then found he could not go on.
Rake seemed to understand, for he sighed and said, "Yes, a most dubious peace. For so many, the peace of death. As for unification, well, that proved woefully short-lived, did it not? Still, I wonder, if I had succeeded, truly succeeded, would that have changed her mind?"
"My lord, something is happening."
"Yes."
"What must we do?"
"Ah, my friend, you are right to ask that. Never mind the High Priestess and her answer. Always the same one with her, yes? Who cries the war cry of Khorald Galain? Let us seek the answer between her legs. Even that can grow tiresome eventually. Although, do not repeat my words to Spinok Durav. I would not disaffect his occasional pleasure." Endest Silan wanted to shriek, wanted to lunge against his lord, grasp him by the neck and force out. Force out what? He did not know. The Son of Darkness was, to his mind, the smartest creature, mortal, immortal, it mattered not, that he had ever met. His thoughts travelled 1,000 tracks simultaneously, and no conversation with him could be predicted, no path deemed certain. "I cannot give answer this time," Anamanda Rake then said, "nor, I am afraid, can Spinok. He will be needed elsewhere. and now his head turned, and his eyes fixed upon Endest Silan. It must fall to you again, once more. Endest felt his soul recoil in horror, shrink back into whatever cave it had clawed out for itself somewhere down in the mined-out pit of his heart.
Sire, I cannot!
Anamanda seemed to consider that for a time. 10,000 tracks danced across, onto something new that triggered faint surprise on his features, and he smiled. I understand. I will not ask again, then.
Then what? Who? Sire, I do not...
The wryness of Anamanda Rake's tone jarred terribly with his words. Reborn into fury. Oh, would that I could see that. Then his voice grew sober. You were right. You cannot stand in my stead. Do not intercede in any way, Endest Silan. Do not set yourself between two forces, neither of which you can withstand. You may well feel the need, but defy it with all your will. You must not be lost.
Sire, I do not understand.
But Anamanda Rake raised one hand. And yes, the emanation was gone. Darkness was silent once more. Whatever had come into their world had vanished. Endest found he was trembling.
Will it return, my lord?
The son of darkness studied him with strangely veiled eyes, then rose and walked over to the window. Look, the seas grow calm once more. A most worthy lesson, I think. Nothing lasts forever. Not violence, not peace, not sorrow, old friend, nor rage. Look well upon this black sea, Endest Silan, in the nights ahead, to calm your fears, to offer you guidance. And just like that, he knew he was dismissed. Bemused, frightened of a future he knew he was not intelligent enough to yet comprehend, he bowed, then departed. Corridors and stairs, and not so much as an echo remained. He recalled an old prayer, the one whispered before battle. Let darkness receive my every breath with her own. Let our lives speak in answer unto death, never alone. But now, at this moment, he had never felt more alone. The warriors no longer voiced that prayer, he well knew. Darkness did not wait to receive a breath, nor the last breath that bridged life and death. A Tist Andi warrior fought in silence, and when he or she fell, they fell alone. More profoundly alone than anyone who was not Tist Andi could comprehend. A new vision entered his head then, jarring him, halting him halfway down the stairs. The High Priestess, back arching, crying out in ecstasy, or desperation. Was there truly a difference? Her search, her answer that was no answer at all.
Yes, she speaks for us, does she not?
He is troubled,
Saland murmured, only now shaking off the violent cold that had gripped her.
The Redeemer stirred awake then, for some reason unknown, and to us unknowable. But I felt him. He is most troubled.
The half-dozen pilgrims gathered round the fire all nodded, although none possessed her percipience in these matters, too bound up still in the confused obstinacy of mortality's incessant demands. And, of course, there was the dread now, the one that had stalked them every moment since the Benighted's abandonment, an abandonment they saw as a turning away, which was deemed just, because none there had proved worthy of Seodamin and the protection he offered. Yes, he was right in denying them. They had all failed him, in some way as yet undetermined. Saland understood all these notions, and even, to some extent, this alone surprising given her few years, comprehended the nature of self-abnegation that could give rise to them. People in great need were quick to find blame in themselves, quick to assume the burden of guilt for things they in truth had no control over and could not hope to change. It was, she had begun to understand, integral to the very nature of belief, of faith, A need that could not be answered by the self was then given over to someone or something greater than oneself, and this form of surrender was a lifting of a vast, terrible weight. In faith could be found release, relief.
And so this enormous contradiction is laid bare. The believers yield all into the arms of the Redeemer, who by his very nature can release nothing, can find nothing in the way of relief, and so can never surrender. Where then the Redeemer's reward?
Such questions were not for her. Perhaps indeed they were beyond answering. For now there was before her a mundane concern of the most sordid kind. A dozen ex-soldiers, probably from the Panion Tenebri, now terrorized the pilgrim encampment, robbing the new arrivals before they could set their treasures upon the barrow. There had been beatings and now a rape. This informal gathering, presumably the camp's representatives, had sought her out, pleading for help. But what could she say to them? "We were wrong to believe in the benighted. I am sorry. He was not what we thought he was. He looked into my eyes and he refused. I am sorry. I cannot help you."
"You say the Redeemer is troubled, priestess," said the spokesman, a wiry middle-aged man who had once been a merchant in Kapustan, fleeing west before the siege, a refugee in Saltoan, who had seen with his own eyes the expulsion, the night when the advance agents of the Panion Domin were driven out of that city. He had been among the first of the pilgrims to arrive at the great barrow, and now it seemed he would stay, perhaps for the rest of his life. Whatever wealth he had once possessed was now part of the barrow, now a gift to a god who had been a man he had once seen with his own eyes.
"Surely this is because of Gradithan and his thugs. The Redeemer was a soldier in his life. Will he not reach out and smite those who prey upon his followers?"
Salind held out her hands, palms up.
"Friend, we do not converse. My only gift is this sensitivity. But I do not believe that the source of the Redeemer's disquiet lies in the deeds of Gradithan and his cohorts. There was a burgeoning of something, not close at hand, yet of such power to make the ether tremble."
She hesitated, then said,
"It had the flavor of Coralt Galain, the warren of the Tist Andi, and," she frowned, "something else that I have felt before, many times, in fact, as if a storm raged far to the south, one that returns again and again."
Blank faces stared at her. Salind sighed.
"See the clouds roll in from the sea. Can we halt their progress? Can we, any of us, drive back the winds and rain, the hail? No, such forces are far above us, far beyond our reach, and they rage as they will, fighting wars in the heavens. This, my friends, is what I am feeling when something ripples through the ether, when a storm awakens to the south, when the Redeemer shifts uneasy and is troubled."
"Then we are nothing to him," said the merchant, sorrow brimming in his eyes. "I surrendered everything, all my wealth, for yet another indifferent god. If he cannot protect us, what is the point?"
She wished that she had an answer to such questions. Were these not the very grist of priestly endeavors? To grind out palatable answers, to hint of promising paths to true salvation? To show a benign countenance gifted by God-given wisdom, glowing as if fanned by sacred breath?
"It is my feeling," she said haltingly, "that a faith that delivers perfect answers to every question is not a true faith, for its only purpose is to satisfy, to ease the mind and so end its questing."
She held up a hand to still the objections she saw awakened among these six honest, serious believers.
"Is it for faith to deliver peace when on all sides inequity thrives?
for it shall indeed thrive, when the blessed walk past blissfully blind, content in their own moral purity, in the peace filling their souls. Oh, you might then reach out a hand to the wretched by the roadside, offering them your own footprints, and you may see the blessed burgeon in number grow into a multitude until you are as an army. But there will be, will ever be, those who turn away from your hand, the ones who quest because it is in their nature to quest, who fear the seduction of self-satisfaction, who mistrust easy answers. Are these ones then to be your enemy? Does the army grow angered now? Does it strike out at the unbelievers? Does it crush them underfoot? My friends, is this not describing the terror this land has just survived? Her eyes fixed on the merchant. Is this not what destroyed Capustan? Is this not what the rulers of Saltoan so violently rejected when they drove out the Panian monks? Is this not what the Redeemer died fighting against?
None of this, growled a woman. Eases my daughter's pain. She was raped, and now there is nothing to be seen in her eyes. She has fled herself and may never return. Gradithan took her and destroyed her. Will he escape all punishment for such a thing? He laughed at me when I picked up my daughter. When I stood before him with her limp in my arms, he laughed at me.
The benighted must return, said the merchant. He must defend us. He must explain to us how we failed him.
Saland studied the faces before her, seeing the fear and the anger, the pain and the growing despair. It was not in her to turn them away, yet what could she do? She did not ask to become a priestess. She was not quite sure how it even happened. And what of her own pain, her own broken history? What of the flesh she had once taken into her mouth? Not the bloody meat of a stranger, no. The firstborn of the Tenascauri, children of the dead seed. Ah, they were to be special, yes, so special, willing to eat their own kin. And was that not proof of how special they were? What then of the terrible need that had brought her here?
You must go to him, said the merchant. We know where to find him, in Black Coral. I can lead you to him, priestess. Together we will demand his help. He was a Seerdemin, a chosen sword of the tyrant. He owes us. He owes us all.
I have tried.
I will help you, insisted the merchant. I will show him our desire to mend our ways, to accord the benighted the proper respect.
Others nodded, and the merchant took this in and went on.
We will help, all of us here. We will stand with you, priestess. Once he is made to understand what is happening, once we confront him, there in that damned tavern with that damned Tist Andy he games with, how can he turn away from us yet again?
But what of fairness? What of Seerdemin and his own wounds? See the zeal in your fellows, see it in yourself, then ask, where is my compassion when I stand before him, shouting my demands? Why will none of you defend yourselves?
Priestess!
Very well.
And she rose, drawing her woolen robe tight about herself.
Lead on, then, merchant, to where he may be found.
A man huddled against the counter, sneezing fiercely enough to loosen his teeth. And while this barrage went on, none at the table attempted to speak. Hands reached for tankards. Kellick glistened on lips, and eyes shone murky and fixed with intent upon the field of battle. Spinnok Durav waited for Seerdemin to make a move, to attempt something unexpected in the shoring up of his buckling defences. The man was always good for a surprise or two, a flash of tactical genius that could well halt Spinnok in his tracks, even make him stagger. And was this not the very heart of the contest, its bright hint of glory? The sneezing fit ended, something that evidently came of too much Kellick. A sudden flux of the sinuses, followed by an alarmingly dark discharge. He'd begun to see stains on walls and pavestones and cobbles all over the city now. This foreign drink was outselling even ale and wine. And among the drinkers there were now emerging abusers, stumbling glaze-eyed, mouths hanging, tongues like black worms. As yet, Spinnock had not seen such among the Tist Andi, but perhaps it was only a matter of time. He sipped at his cup of wine, pleased to note that the trembling in his fingers had finally ceased. The eruption of power from Corald Galain that had taken him so unawares had vanished, leaving little more than a vague unease that only slightly soured the taste of the wine. Strange disturbances these nights. Who could say their portent? The High Priestess might have an idea or two, he suspected, although the punctuation of every statement from her never changed now, did it? Half smiling, he sipped again at his drink. Theodomin frowned and sat back. "This is an assault I cannot survive," he pronounced. "The jester's deceit was well played, Spinnock. There was no anticipating that."
"Truly?" Spinnock asked. "With these allies here?"
Theodomin grimaced at the other two players, then grunted a sour laugh.
"Ah, yes, I see your point. That Kellick takes their minds, I think."
"Sharpens, just so you know," said Garston, licking his stained lips. "Although I'd swear some nights it's more potent than other times. Wouldn't you say so, Fuldit?"
"Eh? Yeah, suppose so. When you gonna move then, Theodomin? Eh? Resto, bring us another bottle."
"Perhaps," muttered Theodomin, "it's my mind that's not sharp. I believe I must surrender."
Spinnock said nothing, although he was disappointed. No, he was shaken. He could see a decent counter, had been assuming his opponent had seen it immediately, but had been busy seeking something better, something wilder. Other nights, Seerdomin's talent would burst through at moments like these, a fearless gambit that seemed to pivot the world on this very tabletop.
"Perhaps if I wait a little longer..." "I yield," said Seerdomin.
Words uttered, a crisis pronounced.
"Resto, bring us a pitcher, if you'd be so..."
Seerdomin got no further. He seemed to jolt back into his chair, as if an invisible hand had just slammed into his chest. His eyes were on the tavern door. Spinnock twisted in his seat to see that strangers had arrived at the Scaur. A young woman wearing a rough-woven russet robe, her hair cut short, shorter even than the High Priestess's, yet the same midnight black. A pale face, both soft and exquisite, eyes of deep brown, now searching through the gloom, finding at last the one she sought, Theodomin. Behind her crowded others, all wearing little more than rags, their wan faces tight with something like panic. The woman in the lead walked over. Theodomin sat like a man nailed to his chair. All color had left his face a moment earlier, but now it was darkening, his eyes flaring with hard anger.
"Benighted.
This is my refuge," he said. "Leave, now."
We?
Look at your followers, priestess."
She turned, in time to see the last of them rush out of the tavern door. Theodomin snorted. Impressively, the young woman held her ground. The robe fell open, lacking a belt, and Spinnock Durav judged she was barely adolescent. A priestess?
"Ah, the great Barrow, the Redeemer."
"Benighted,"
she resumed, in a voice that few would find hard to listen to, indeed at length.
"I am not here for myself. Those who were with me insisted, and even if their courage failed them at the end, this makes their need no less valid."
"They came with demands," Theodomin said. "They have no right, and they realized the truth of that as soon as they saw me. You should now do the same and leave as they have."
"I must try."
Theodomin surged to his feet, suddenly enough to startle Garston and Fuldit, despite their addled senses, and both stared up wide-eyed and frightened. The priestess did not even flinch.
"I must try," she repeated, "for their sake and for my own.
We are beset in the camp.
No, cut in Cerdamin, you have no right.
Please, will you just listen?
The hard edge of those words clearly surprised Cerdamin. Garston and Fuldit, collecting their tankards and bottles, quickly left the table. Spinnok Durav rose, bowed slightly to both, and made for the exit. As he passed Resto, who stood motionless with a pitcher in his hand, he said under his breath,
On my tab, please, this entire night. Cerdamin will have no thought of you when he leaves.
Resto blinked up at him, then nodded. In the darkness opposite the scour's door, Spinnok Durav waited. He had half expected to see the pilgrims waiting outside, but the street was empty. They had fled indeed, at a run, probably all the way back to the camp. There was little spine in the followers of the Redeemer. With at least one exception, he corrected himself as the priestess stepped outside. Even from 10 paces away, he saw her sag slightly, as if finding herself on suddenly watery legs. Tugging the robe tight round herself, she set off, 3-4 strides, then slowed and finally halted to turn and face Spinnok Durav, who came forward.
My pardon, priestess, he said.
Your friend took that pitcher for himself, she said. Expect a long night. If you have a care, you can collect him in a few bells. I'd rather he not spend a senseless night lying on that filthy floor.
I would have thought the possibility might please you, Spinnok said.
She frowned.
No, he is the benighted.
And what does that mean?
She hesitated, then said,
Each day until recently, he came to the great barrow and knelt before it. Not to pray, not to deliver a trinket.
Confused, Spinnok Durav asked,
What then?
He would rather that remain a secret, I suspect.
Priestess, he is my friend. I see well his distress.
And why does that bother you so? More than a friend might feel, I can sense that. Most friends might offer sympathy, even more. But within them remains the stone thought that they are thankful that they themselves do not share their friend's plight. But that is not within you, not with this Cerdamin. No.
She drew a step closer, eyes searching.
He answers a need, and so wounded as he now is, you begin to bleed.
Mother Dark Woman!
She retreated at his outburst and looked away.
I am sorry. Sir, the benighted kneels before the great barrow and delivers unto the Redeemer the most precious gift of all, company. Asking for nothing, he comes to relieve the Redeemer's loneliness.
She ran a hand back through her short hair.
I sought to tell him something, but he would not hear me.
Can I?
I doubt it. I tried to tell him what I am sensing from the Redeemer. Sir, your friend is missed.
She sighed, turning away.
If all who worship did so without need. If all came to their Saviour unmindful of that title and its burden, if they came as friends,
she glanced back at him,
what would happen then, do you think? I wonder.
He watched her walk away, feeling humbled, too shaken to pursue, to root out the answers, the details he needed most, to find out what he could do for Cerdamin, for her.
For her? Now why should she matter? By the abyss, what has she done to me? And how in the mother's name can Cerdamin resist her?
How many women had there been? He had lost count. It would have been better, perhaps, if he'd at least once elected to share his gift of longevity. Better, yes, than watching those few who'd remained with him for any length of time lose all their beauty, surrendering their youth, until there was no choice but for Kalahor to discard them, to lock them away, one by one, in some tower on some windswept knoll. What else could he have done? They hobbled into lives of misery, and that misery was an affront to his sensibilities. Too much bitterness, too much malice in those hot, aging eyes ever fixing upon him. Did he not age as well? True, a year for them was but a heartbeat for Kalor, but see the lines of his face, see the slow wasting of muscle, the iron hue of his hair. It was not just a matter of choosing the slowest burning wood, after all, was it? And with that thought he kicked at the coals of the fire, watched sparks roil nightward. Sometimes the urgent flames of the quick and the short-lived delivered their own kind of heat. Hard wood and slow burn, soft wood and smouldering reluctance before ashen collapse. Resinous wood, and oh, how she flared! Blinding, yes, a glory no man could turn from. Too bad he'd had to kill every child he begat. No doubt that left most of his wives and lovers somewhat disaffected. But he had not been so cruel as to hesitate, had he? No. Why, he'd tear those ghastly babes from their mother's arms not moments after they'd tumbled free of the womb, and was that not a true sign of mercy? No one grows attached to dead things, not even mothers. Attachments, yes. Now they were indeed a waste of time, and, more relevantly, a weakness. To rule an empire, to rule 100 empires, one needed a certain objectivity. All was to be used, to be remade howsoever he pleased. Why, he had launched vast construction projects to glorify his rule, but few understood that it was not the completion that mattered, but the work itself and all that it implied. His command over their lives, their loyalty, their labor. Why, he could work them for decades, see generations of the fools pass one by one, all working each and every day of their lives, and still they did not understand what it meant for them to give to him, to Kalor, so many years of their mortal existence, so much of it, truly, that any rational soul would howl at the cruel injustice of such a life. This was, as far as he was concerned, the real mystery of civilization. And for all that he exploited it, he was, by the end, no closer to understanding it. This willingness of otherwise intelligent, well, reasonably intelligent, people to parcel up and then bargain away appalling percentages of their very limited lives, all in service to someone else. And the rewards? Ah, some security, perhaps. The cement that is stability. A sound roof, something on the plate, the beloved offspring, each one destined to repeat the whole travail. And was that an even exchange? It would not have been so for him. He knew that, had known it from the very first. He would bargain away nothing of his life. He would serve no one, yield none of his labor to the edification and ever-expanding wealth of some fool who imagined that his or her own part of the bargain was profound in its generosity. Was indeed the most precious of gifts. That to work for him or her was a privilege. Gods, the conceit of that, the lie so bristling and charged in its brazen display. Just how many rules of civil behavior were designed to perpetuate such egregious schemes of power and control of the few over the many? Rules defended to the death, usually the death of the many, rarely that of the few, with laws and wars, with threats and brutal repression. Ah, those were the days, were they not? How he had gloried in that outrage! He would never be one of the multitude, and he had proved it again and again and again, and he would continue to prove it. A crown was within reach. A kingship waited to be claimed. Mastery not over something as mundane as an empire, that game had grown stale long ago, but over a realm, an entity consisting of all the possible forces of existence, the power of earthly flesh, every element unbound, the coruscating will of belief, the skein of politics, religion, social accord, sensibilities, woven from the usual tragic roots of past ages, golden and free of pain, and new ages bright with absurd promise. While through it all fell the rains of oblivion, the cascading torrent of failure and death, suffering and misery, a god broken and forever doomed to remain so.
Oh, Calor knew he could usurp such a creature, leave it as powerless as his most abject subject. All of it within his reach. He kicked again at the embers, the two small branches that had made up this short-lived fire, saw countless twigs fall into white ash. A few picked bones were visible amidst the coals, all that remained of the pathetic creature he had devoured earlier this night. A smear of clouds cut a swath across the face of the stars, and the dust-veiled moon had yet to rise. Somewhere out on the plain, coyotes bickered with the night. He had found trader tracks this past day, angling northwest-southeast, well-worn wagon ruts, the tramping of yoked oxen. Garbage strewn to either side. Rather disappointing, all things considered. He had grown used to solitude, where the only sign of human activity had been the occasional grass fire on the western horizon, plains nomads and their mysterious ways. Something to do with the Bedouin herds and the needs for various grasses, he suspected. If they spied him, they wisely kept their distance. His passing through places had a way of agitating ancient spirits, a detail he had once found irritating enough to hunt the things down and kill them, but no longer. Let them whine and twitch, thrash and moan in the grip of timorous nightmares and all that. Let their mortal children cower in the high grasses until he was well and gone. The High King had other concerns, and other matters with which he could occupy his mind. He sat straighter, every sense stung awake by a burgeoning of power to the north. Slowly rising to his feet, Kalos stared into the darkness. Yes, something foaming awake. What might it be? And, yes, another force, and that one he well recognized, Tist Andi. Breath hissed between worn teeth. Of course, if he continued on this path, he would have come full circle, back to that horrid place. What was its name? Yes, Coral. The whole mess with the Panion Domain. Oh, the stupidity, the pathetic, squalid idiocy of that day. Could this be those two accursed hunters? Had they somehow swept round him? Were they now striking south to finally face him? Well, he might welcome that. He'd killed his share of dragons, both pure and solitarken. One at a time, of course. Two at once. That could be a challenge. For all this time, their pursuit had been a clumsy, witless thing. So easily fooled, led astray, he could have ambushed them countless times, and perhaps he should have done just that. At the very least, he might have come to understand the source of their persistent, yes, pathological, relentlessness. Had he truly angered Rake that much? It seemed ridiculous. The Son of Darkness was not one to become so obsessed. Indeed, none of the Tist Andi were. And was that not their fundamental weakness, this failing of will? How had he so angered Korlat and Orphantal? Was it because he did not stay, did not elect to fight alongside all the doomed fools on that day? Let the Malazans bleed. They were our enemies. Let the Tlani Mas betray Silver Fox. She deserved it. It was not our war, Brood. Not our war, Rake. Why didn't you listen to me? Bah, come and face me then, Korlat, Orphantal. Come, let us be done with this rubbish. The twin flaring of powers ebbed suddenly. Somewhere far to the east, the coyotes resumed their frantic cries. He looked skyward, saw the gleam of the rising moon, its ravaged scowl of reflected sunlight, and the blighted dust of its stirred slumber. Look at you. Your face is my face. Let us be truthful about that. Beaten and boxed about, yet we climb upright time and again to resume our trek. The sky cares nothing for you, dear one. The stars don't even see you. But you will march on, because it is what you do. A final kick at the coals. Let the grasses burn to scar his wake. He cared not. No, he would not come full circle. He never did, which was what had kept him alive for this long.
No point in changing anything, was there? Kalor set out, northward. There were, if he recalled, settlements and roads and a main trader track skirling west and north, out across the cinnamon wastes, all the way to Darujistan, where he had an appointment to keep, a destiny to claim by right of sword and indomitable will. The moon's light took hold of his shadow and made a mess of it. Kalor walked on, oblivious of such details. 3 scrawny horses, 1 neglected ox, and a wagon with a bent axle and a cracked brake. The amassed inherited wealth of the village of Morsko comprised only these. Bodies left to rot on the tavern floor. They should have set fire to the place, Nimander realized. Too late now, too hard the shove away from that horrid scene. And what of the victims on their crosses, wrapped and leaking black ichors into the muddy earth? They had left them as well. Motionless beneath a blanket in the bed of the wagon, Clip stared sightlessly at the sideboards. Flecks of the porridge they had forced down his throat that morning studded his chin. Flies crawled and buzzed round his mouth. Every now and then, faint trembling rippled through his body. Stolen away. Noon, the 3rd day now on this well-made, cobbled, gutted road. They had just passed south of the town of Heath, which had once been a larger settlement, perhaps a city, and might well return to such past glory, this time on the riches of Kellick, a dilute form of Saman Kellick, the blood of the dying god. These details and more they had learned from the merchant trains rolling up and down this road, scores of wagons setting out virtually empty to villages and towns east of Bastion, to Outlook itself, then returning loaded with amphorae of the foul drink, wagons groaning beneath the weight, back to some form of central distribution hub in Bastion. The road itself ran south of these settlements, all of which nested above the shoreline of Pilgrim Lake. When it came opposite a village, there would be a junction with a track or wend leading north. A more substantial crossroads marked the intersection of levelled roads to the reviving cities of Heath, Kel'Tor, and, somewhere still ahead, Sarn. Nimander and his group did not travel disguised, did not pretend to be other than what they were, and it was clear that the priests, fleeing ahead of them, had delivered word to all their kin on the road, and, from there, presumably into the towns and villages. At the junctions, in the ramshackle way stations and storage sheds, food and water and forage for the animals awaited them. The dying god, or his priests, had blessed them, apparently, and now awaited their pleasure in Bastion. The one who had sacrificed his soul to the dying god was doubly blessed, and some final consummation was anticipated, probably leading to Clip's souls being thoroughly devoured by an entity who was cursed to suffer for eternity. Thus accursed, it was little wonder the creature welcomed company. All things considered, it was well that their journey had been one of ease and accommodation. Nimander suspected that his troop would have been rather more pleased to carve their way through hordes of frenzied fanatics, assuming they could manage such a thing. Having confirmed that Clip's comatose condition was unchanged, he climbed down from the wagon and returned to the scruffy mare he had been riding since Morsko. The poor beast's ribs had been like the bars of a cage under tattered vellum, its eyes listless and its tan coat patchy and dull. In the 3 days since, despite the steady riding, the animal had recovered somewhat under Nimander's ministrations. He was not particularly enamored of horses in general, but no creature deserved to suffer. As he climbed into the worn saddle, he saw Skintik standing, stepping up onto the wagon's bench where Nananda sat holding the reins, and shading his eyes to look southward across the empty plain. "See something?" A moment, then, "Yes, someone walking." "Up from the south?" "But there's nothing out there." Kedavis and Aranatha rose in their stirrups.
"Let's get going," Desra said from the wagon bed. "It's too hot to be just sitting here."
Nimander could see the figure now, tall for a human. Unkempt, straggly grey hair fanned out round his head like an aura. He seemed to be wearing a long coat of chain, down to halfway between his knees and ankles, slitted in front. The hand and a half grip of a great sword rose above his left shoulder.
"An old bastard," muttered Skintik, "to be walking like that."
"Could be he lost his horse," said Nananda disinterestedly. "Destra is right. We should be going."
Striding like one fevered under the sun, the stranger came ever closer. Something about him compelled Nimanda's attention, a kind of dark fascination, for what he couldn't quite name. A cascade of images tumbled through his mind, as if he was watching an apparition bludgeoning its way out from some hoary legend, from a time when gods struggled, hands about each other's throats, when blood fell as rain and the sky itself rolled and crashed against the shores of the abyss. All this riding across the dusty air between them as the old man came up to the road. All this written in the deep lines of his gaunt visage, in the bleak wastelands of his grey eyes.
"He is as winter," murmured Skintik.
"Yes, and something colder."
"What city lies beyond?" the man asked.
A startled moment when Nimanda realized that the stranger had spoken Tist Andi.
"Heath." The man turned, faced west. "This way, then, lies Bastion and the Cinnamon Track."
Nimanda shrugged.
"You are from Coral?"
the stranger asked, scanning the group.
"Is he still camped there, then? But no, I recognize none of you, and that would not be possible. Even so, tell me why I should not kill you all."
That got Nananda's attention, and he twisted in his seat to sneer down at the old man. But Nimanda's blood had turned to ice.
"Because, sir, you do not know us."
Pale eyes settled on him.
"You have a point, actually. Very well, instead I would travel with you. Ride, yes, in your wagon. I have worn my boots through crossing this wretched plain. Tell me, have you water, decent food?"
Nananda twisted further to glare at Nimanda.
"Turn this fool away. He can drink our dust."
The old man regarded Nananda for a moment, then turned back to Nimanda.
"Tie a leash on this one, and we should be fine."
And he stepped up to the wagon and, setting a foot on a spoke of the rear wheel, pulled himself up, where he paused, frowning as he studied the prostrate form of Clip.
"Is he ill?" he asked Desra. "Are you caught with plague?" "No, not that. Your kind rarely succumb to such things. Stop staring, child, and tell me what is wrong with this one."
"None of your business," she snapped, as Nimanda had known she would. "If you're going to crowd in, then sit there to give him some shade."
Thin brows lifted, then a faint smile flickered across his withered, cracked lips. And without another word, he moved to where Desra had indicated and settled down, stretching out his legs.
"Some water, darling, if you please."
She stared at him for a moment, then pulled loose a skin and slid it over.
"That one's not water," she said with a sweet smile. "It's called Kelik, a local brew, very popular."
Nimanda sat motionless, watching all this. He saw that Skintik and Nananda were both doing the same. At Desra's words, the old man grimaced.
"I'd rather water," he said,
but reached for the skin anyway, tugged free the stopper, then sniffed, and recoiled.
"Imperial dust!" he said in a growl.
He replaced the stopper and flung the skin to the back of the wagon.
"If you won't spare water, then never mind, bitch. We can settle your inhospitality later."
"Desra," said Nimanda as he gathered his reins, "give the man some water."
"After he called me a bitch?"
"After you tried poisoning him with Kelik, yes."
They set out on the road westward. 2 more days, said the last trader they had passed that morning, past Sarn and the Lesser Lake, to Bastion, the city by the inland sea, a sea so filled with salt no sailor or fisher could drown in it, and where no fish could be found barring an enormous eel with the jaws of a wolf. Salt that had not been there a generation ago, but the world will change, amen. The abject temple of Semen Kelik awaited them in Bastion. 2 days, then, to meet the dying god, and, one way or another, to wrest from it Clip's soul. Nemanda did not think the priests would just step aside for that. Riding his mount alongside the wagon, Nemanda spoke to the old man.
If you are going to Bastion, sir, you might want to reconsider staying with us.
And why is that? There was little in that tone, even remotely interrogative.
I don't think I can adequately explain why, Nemanda replied. You'll just have to take me at my word.
Instead, the old man unslung his weapon and set it between him and Clip. Then he laced his long-fingered hands behind his head and settled back, closing his eyes.
Wake me when it's time to eat, he said.
The worn grip and nicked pommel of the great sword, the broad cross-hilt and the scarred wooden scabbard all drew Nemanda's attention. He can still use that damned weapon, ancient as he is. Grim legends, the clangor of warring gods, yes, this gaunt warrior belonged to such things. He collected his reins.
As you like, stranger.
Nudging the mare into a trot, he glanced up to meet Skintik's gaze as he rode past, and saw none of the usual mocking pleasure. Instead, something wan, distraught. True, there was not much to laugh about, was there?
My unhappy kin.
Onward then to Bastion. A succession of ridges stepped down towards the basin of the valley, each marking a time when the river had been wider, its cold waters churning away from dying glaciers and meltwater lakes. Now a narrow, twisting gully threaded along the distant floor, fringed by cottonwoods. Standing upon the highest ridge, Traveller looked down to the next level, where a half dozen teepees rose, not quite breaking the high ground skyline. Figures moving about, clothed in tanned hides and skins, a few dogs, the latter now padding out to the camp's edge closest to the slope. Sharp ears and lifted noses alerted to his presence, although not one barked. A herd of horses foraged further down, a small, stocky steppe breed that Traveller had never seen before. Ochre flanks deepening to brown on the haunches, manes and tails almost black. Down on the valley floor, some distance to the right, carrion birds were on the ground, perched on islands of dead flesh beneath the branches of cottonwoods. Other horses wandered there, these ones more familiar, trailing reins as they cropped the high grasses. Two men walked out to the base of the slope. Traveller set out down towards them. His own escort of hounds had left him this morning, either off on a hunt or gone for good. There was no telling which. Sun-burnished faces watched him approach, eyes nestled in wind-stretched epicanthic folds, midnight black hair in loosely bound manes, through which were threaded, rather sweetly, white blossoms, long, narrow-bladed curved knives in beaded belts, the iron black except along the honed edges. Their clothing was beautifully sewn with red-dyed gut thread, studded here and there with bronze rivets. The elder one, on the right, now held up both hands, palms outward, and said in archaic Daru,
"Master of the wolf horses, welcome. Do not kill us. Do not rape our women. Do not steal our children. Leave us with no diseases. Leave us our Gathend horses of the rock, our mute dogs, our food and our shelters, our weapons and our tools. Eat what we give you. Drink what we give you. Smoke what we give you. Thank us for all three. Grant your seed if a woman comes to you in the night. Kill all vermin you find. Kiss with passion, caress with tenderness. Gift us with the wisdom of your years, but none of their bitterness. Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not hate, do not fear, and neither will we hate or fear you. Do not invite your wolf horses into our camp, lest they devour us and all our beasts. Welcome then, wanderer, and we will tell you of matters and show you other matters. We are the Kindaru, keepers of the horses of the rock, the last clan left in all Lama Teth Andath. The grasses we have made so that trees do not reach high to steal the sky. Welcome. You need a bath.
To such a greeting, Traveller could only stand silent, amused, torn between laughter and weeping. The younger of the two men, perhaps in his mid-twenties, smiled wryly and said,
"The more strangers we meet, the more we add to our words of welcome. This is born of experience, most of it sad, unpleasant. If you mean us harm, we ask that you heed the words given you, and so turn away. Of course, if you mean to betray us, then there is nothing we can do. Deceit is not our way."
Traveller grimaced.
"Deceit is everyone's way."
Twin expressions of dismay, so similar that it was made clear they were father and son.
"Yes," said the son, "that is true. If we saw that you would enter our camp and be with us, yet plan betrayal, why, we would plan the same, and seek to deliver unto you first what you thought to deliver unto us."
"You are truly the last camp left."
"Yes, we are waiting to die. Our ways, our memories. And the Gathend will run free once more, until they too are gone. For the horses we keep are the last of their kind too."
"Do you ride them?"
"No, we worship them."
Yet they spoke Daru. What strange history twisted and isolated these ones from all the others? What turned them away from farms and villages, from cities and riches?
"Kendaru, I humbly accept your welcome and will strive to be a worthy guest."
Both men now smiled, and the younger one gestured with one hand. A faint sound behind him made Traveller turn to see four nomads rising as if from nowhere on the slope, armed with spears. Traveller looked back at the father and son.
"You are all too familiar with strangers, I think."
They walked down into the camp. The silent dogs, ranging ahead, were met by a small group of children, all bedecked in white flowers. Bright smiles flashed up at Traveller, tiny hands taking his to lead him onward to the hearth fires, where women were now preparing a midday meal. Iron pots filled with some milky substance steamed, the smell pungent, sweet, and vaguely alcoholic. A low bench was set out, four-legged and padded, the woven coverlet a rainbow of coloured threads in zigzag patterns. The wooden legs were carved into horse heads, noses almost touching in the middle, the manes flowing in sweeping curves, all stained a lustrous ochre and deep brown. The artistry was superb, the head so detailed Traveller could see the veins along the cheeks, the lines of the eyelids and the dusty eyes both opaque and depthless. There was only one such bench, and it was, he knew, to be his for the duration of his stay. The father and son and three others of the band, two women and a very old man, all sat cross-legged in a half-circle, facing him across the fire. The children finally released his hands, and a woman gave him a gourd filled with the scalded milk in which floated strips of meat.
"Skathandi," said the father. "Camped down by the water, here to ambush us and steal our horses, for the meat of the Gathend is highly prized by people in the cities. There were 30 in all, raiders and murderers. We will eat their horses, but you may have one to ride if you desire so."
Traveller sipped the milk, and as the steam filled his face, his eyes widened. Fire in his throat, then blissful numbness. Blinking tears from his eyes, he tried to focus on the man who had spoken.
"You sprang the ambush, then? 30? You must be formidable warriors."
"This was the second such camp we found. All slain. Not by us, friend. Someone, it seems, likes the Skathandi even less than we do."
The father hesitated, and in the pause his son said,
"It was our thought that you were following that someone."
"Ah," Traveller frowned. "Someone? There is but one. One who attacks Skathandi camps and slaughters everyone?"
Nods answered him.
"A demon, we think, who walks like a storm, dark with terrible rage. One who covers well his tracks."
The son made an odd gesture with one hand,
a rippling of the fingers.
Like a ghost.
How long ago did this demon travel past here?
3 days.
Are these Scathandi a rival tribe?
No. Raiders preying on caravans and all who dwell on the plain. Sworn, it is said, to a most evil man, known only as the Captain. If you see an 8-wheeled carriage, so high there is 1 floor above and a balcony with a golden rail, drawn, it is said, by 1,000 slaves, then you will have found the palace of this Captain. He sends out his raiders and grows fat on the trade of his spoils.
I am not following this demon, said Traveller. I know nothing of it.
That is probably well.
It heads north?
Yes.
Traveller thought about that as he took another sip of the appallingly foul drink. With a horse under him, he would begin to make good time, but that might well take him right on to that demon, and he did not relish a fight with a creature that could slay 30 bandits and leave nary a footprint. One child, who had been kneeling beside him, piling handfuls of dirt onto Traveller's boot top, now clambered up onto his thigh, reached into the gourd and plucked out a sliver of meat and waved it in front of Traveller's mouth.
Eat, said the son. The meat is from a turtle that tunnels, very tender. The miska milk softens it and removes the poison. One generally does not drink the miska, as it can send the mind travelling so far that it never returns. Too much, and it will eat holes in your stomach, and you will die in great pain.
Ah, you could have mentioned that earlier.
Traveller took the meat from the child. He was about to plop it into his mouth when he paused.
Anything else I should know before I begin chewing?
No. You will dream tonight of tunneling through earth, harmless enough. All food has memory, so the miska proves. We cook everything in it, else we taste the bitterness of death.
Traveller sighed.
This miska, it is mare's milk?
Laughter erupted.
No, no, cried the father. A plant, a root bulb. Mare milk belongs to foals and colts, of course. Humans have their own milk after all, and it is not drunk by adults, only babes. Yours, stranger, is a strange world.
And he laughed some more. Traveller ate the sliver of meat. Most tender, indeed delicious. That night, sleeping beneath firs in a teepee, he dreamt of tunneling through hard-packed, stony earth, pleased by its surrounding warmth, the safety of darkness. He was woken shortly before dawn by a young woman, soft of limb and damp with desire, who wrapped herself tight about him. He was startled when she prized open his mouth with her own and deposited a full mouthful of spit, strongly spiced with something, and would not pull away until he swallowed it down. By the time she and the drug she had given him were done, there was not a seed left in his body. In the morning, Traveller and the father went down to the abandoned Scathandi horses. With help from the mute dogs, they were able to capture one of the animals, a solid, piebald gelding of 16 or so hands with mischief in its eyes. The dead raiders, he noted as his companion went in search among the camp's wreckage for a worthy saddle, had indeed been cut to pieces. Although the work of the scavengers had reduced most of the corpses to tufts of hair, torn sinew and broken bones, there was enough evidence of severed limbs and decapitations to suggest some massive edged weapon at work. Where bones had been sliced through, the cut was sharp, with no sign of crushing. The father brought over the best of the tack, and Traveller saw with surprise that it was a Seven Cities saddle, with Malazan military brands on the leather girth straps. He was just finishing cinching the straps tight, after the gelding could hold its breath no longer, when he heard shouting from the Kindaru camp, and both he and the father turned. A rider had appeared on the same ridge that Traveller had come to yesterday, pausing for but a moment before guiding the mount down into the camp. Traveller swung himself onto his horse and gathered the reins.
"See the beast she rides!" gasped the man beside him. "It is a Jagathend! We are blessed! Blessed!"
And all at once he was running back to the camp.
Traveller set heels to his gelding and rode after the man. The rider was indeed a woman, and Traveller saw almost immediately that she was of Seven Cities stock. She looked harried, threadbare, and worn, but a ferocious fire blazed in her eyes when they fell upon Traveller as he rode into the camp.
"Is there anywhere in the world where I won't run into damned Malazans?"
she demanded. Traveller shrugged.
"And I hardly expected to encounter an Ugari woman on the back of a jag stallion here on the Lammertath Plain."
Her scowl deepened.
"I am told there's a demon travelling through here, heading north, killing everyone in his path and no doubt enjoying every moment of it."
"So it seems."
"Good,"
snapped the woman.
"Why?"
Traveller asked. She scowled.
"So I can give him his damned horse back, that's why.